So what's for dinner? I've always sort of wanted to preach a sermon on the food laws in Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14 just as a bit of a personal challenge to myself to see if what could we make of this. But nevertheless, all kidding aside, this is in the Bible. It is, therefore, we suspect, there for a reason. So we're talking about the food laws, these things that are clean and unclean, things that would be acceptable for the Hebrews to eat, and things that would not be acceptable for them to eat. This is one of the most or more obscure parts of the Old Testament. There's quite a bit in both the Old and New Testaments that's a bit obscure, but this probably ranks pretty high on most people's lists of obscure things in the Bible or things that are difficult to understand in the Bible. And it's also, this is one of the reasons why we as Christians have often looked down on the Jews, God's chosen people, because they have these things, these lists of things that they can eat or that they cannot eat. And in the New Testament, particularly in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 7, verse 19, Jesus says that it is not what goes into the mouth that defiles a person, but rather it is what comes out of the mouth that defiles a person. Because we know, I don't want to get into the dirty details of biological processes here, but what goes into the mouth passes through the body, and, you know, we're familiar with that. But the point of Jesus in Mark 7 is that what comes out of the mouth in speech reflects the condition of one's heart. And one is only able to say what is in one's heart. If one's heart is correct, is true to God, then what issues from one's mouth will be the truth, will be things that honor God. But if one's heart is not true toward God, if one's heart is divided in loyalties, then that which one says will reflect that divided or that impure, that false place. And the Gospel of Luke, volume 2, I suppose, in Acts chapter 10, verse 15, Peter has a vision of a sheet being lowered down from heaven with all sorts of unclean animals on it. And the voice comes to Peter from heaven and says, "Peter, get up and kill and eat." And Peter says, "I will not do so. Nothing unclean has ever come into my mouth." And God says to Peter, "Well, you shall not call anything unclean that God has declared clean." And in the context of Acts, this is a part of the extending of the mission of God to the Gentiles. It is right after this vision that Peter is led to the house of Cornelius to begin the evangelization of the Gentiles. In one of the stores over in SM Taitai a few years ago, it was around Christmas time, and there was a contextualized Filipino nativity set. And, you know, had the man in the barong with his, whatever you call the round hat with the point on the top of it. I don't know what that's called, but he was there and he was roasting his lechon baboy, his roast pig. And I wish I had had my camera to take a picture of this, because I just thought it was so awesome that there's this nativity set, you know, I guess it's Joseph out there is roasting the pig, and Mary's in the house with the baby and the wise men and the shepherds and all of this. But it struck me that a roast pig does not fit in a Jewish household. Filipino household, great, no problem. But it was an interesting bit of contextualization there. And according to the strict language, or strictly following the language of Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14, this should not have been part of the scene. But nevertheless, the artist who created this was extending the idea of celebration, of joy at the coming of the birth of this baby in significant societally appropriate ways. But also, when you think about it, what we eat is a serious ethical issue. Wait. Eating is ethics? Really? It matters what I eat? Well, sure it does. So we ask ourselves, why does it matter? Leviticus 11 says that land animals must chew the cud and have a divided hoof. So things like the camel and the hyrax, whatever a hyrax is, I don't know, maybe some people that are more familiar with various kinds of animals can tell me what a hyrax is, but a rabbit is not allowed, and of course the lechon baboy is not allowed. The sea animals, according to verse 9, must have fins and scales. So I try to playfully argue with my wife that I shouldn't eat shrimp because it doesn't have fins and scales, but it might after all. So maybe that's an argument I can't make. But the sea animals must have fins and scales. And the list of forbidden birds is very long. The eagle and the vulture and the black vulture and the red kite and the black kite and the raven and the horned owl and the screech owl and the gull and the hawk and the little owl and a cormorant. I don't know what a cormorant is either. And the great owl and the white owl and the desert owl and the osprey and the stork and the heron and the hoopoe. I don't know what a hoopoe is either. Or a bat. Well, I don't think I'm going to be eating a bat anyway, but nevertheless, I'm glad it's forbidden in Leviticus 11, so I don't have to worry about it. And then there's insects, eating bugs. Unclean are insects that walk on four legs and fly around, except if they have jointed legs for hopping. So anybody who likes chocolate-covered grasshoppers, okay. No problem. So a locust and a katydid, what did Katy do? And a cricket and a grasshopper, these are okay. You can eat these things. These are clean. You first. And the ground animals that are forbidden, the weasel and the rat and the gecko and the lizard and the skink. I don't know what a skink is. I know what a skunk is. That's thankfully you don't have those here in the Philippines, but I don't know what a skink is, and a chameleon. And then in a parallel list over in Deuteronomy 14, these are the foods that you may eat: ox and sheep and goat and deer and gazelle and roe deer and wild goat and ibex and antelope and mountain sheep and the camel and the rabbit and the hyrax, whatever this thing is forbidden, and the pigs. The birds, the same list as in Leviticus 11, and say flying insects are not allowed. So when I was just on a mission trip to Tacloban in the typhoon affected areas, one of the young men from Singapore that was with us,
it was kind of dark in the room, and he, you know, he's eating his rice, and then he looks down on his plate and kind of jumped, and he saw half of a bug. So you all know what that means, is the other half was, you know, on his. And so another gentleman that was with us picked up the other half and water behind it, so he could identify with this young man. And it also says, do not eat anything that you find already dead. Okay. Well, I'm from the southern United States, so we know about roadkill and things like that. So if it's already dead, well, if you hit it with your car, maybe, well, I don't know. But what's going on here? Why is a list of foods, clean foods and unclean foods, allowed foods and not allowed foods in something like the Bible? And a few different explanations have been given. You know, perhaps these foods are bad for you, and God already knew that. You know, this is the traditional evangelical answer. Well, okay, maybe that's true. I mean, we do know that if you eat too much pork, you know, you might the fat content in your diet may be a little bit too high and things like that. But that doesn't really seem to be a finally satisfactory answer to me, because there are plenty of other things, good things, that if you eat too much of them, you will have some of the same negative effects as if you eat a hoopoe, whatever a hoopoe is. And a second answer is given by the anthropologist Mary Douglas in a book called Purity and Danger, which was published in 1966. And she said that the reason why these particular foods were considered unclean was that they crossed certain boundaries. So for a land animal to be clean, it had to have divided hooves and chew the cud. Both stipulation, the answer to both questions had to be either yes or no. If the answer to one question, does it chew the cud, or does it have divided hooves, was yes, and the answer to the other question was no, then it was not acceptable to be eaten. And because it crossed these boundaries, it was dangerous. And the same way with something in the water. If it did not have fins and scales, it was in the water where the fish belong, but it was not itself a fish, and therefore it was dangerous. Another possibility comes from Martin Jaffe, in his book Early Judaism, published in 1997. He says, eating a meal was a religious activity. What about that possibility? Could we honor God, or maybe dishonor God, by what we eat? And he also says that the dietary restrictions formed an important marker for a sort of identity stamp for the Jewish community to distinguish themselves from the nations all around about. And this is a similar argument to Mary Douglas. She's emphasizing that the categories of animals need to be kept separate and distinct. But Jaffe is suggesting that the categories of people need to be separate and distinct. Harold Kushner, a fourth option, he suggests that The dietary laws are a way of sanctifying ordinary activities. To sanctify means to make holy, right? To take an activity that we have to do to sustain our lives and make it an act of worship to God, making eating a religious activity. Maybe this is what is behind, or one possibility at least, what is behind these lists of clean and unclean foods. And although that it is true for Christians that Jesus has in fact declared all foods clean, so we don't make it a religious injunction against eating lechon baboy. Nevertheless, we can still understand this principle of making the things that we do every day an act of worship to God, a way to honor God in the things that we do, or to dishonor God in the things that we do. And it occurs to me that when we talk about spreading the gospel throughout all the world, we mean geographically, you know, going across cultural and national boundaries and things like that. But we also mean, surely, by that, going into every aspect of people's lives, every aspect of our lives. And it is absolutely 100% important for someone to confess their sins and confess faith in Jesus Christ. But it's more than that. That's only the beginning. Becoming holy is only the beginning. Becoming a Christian is only the beginning. But living a life that God requires has something more to it than that. And they also cause us to think ethically about what we are doing. Rabbi Kushner says, you can be religious in the way you treat food, money, or sex, not only in the way you treat the Bible. And he says, more than 7 billion people on this planet, and God cares what I have for lunch. Think about that. The things we do, folks, are important. All of the things we do every day, practical things, things we need to do to sustain our lives, these too can be an act of worship to God. His eye is on the sparrow. We sing that. So I know He watches me. Well, this is a good thing, but also a scary thing. But God calls us to do something greater, something more, to think about what we're doing. And it is a great responsibility that we have been given. So, a little bit about the difference between human and non-human animals, because we're animals, right? We just call ourselves human. And for the most part, as far as we know, how non-human animals behave is in this way. You know, this is their body, and they have an instinctual input. They realize they're hungry. You know, so far as we know, not on an intellectual level. You know, they don't reason that they're hungry, or this hurt that they're feeling in their tummy is intellectual. They don't make the intellectual connection. Well,
Well, as far as we know, they don't. You know, I've seen some research that suggests maybe how the animals do things is a lot closer to what we would call reason and rationality than we think. I don't know. But as far as we know, when an animal, a non-human animal, receives this instinctual input, they satisfy this instinct through an instinctual output or satisfaction. So therefore, a lion, when a lion is hungry, it goes and chases down a gazelle or a deer or a zebra or whatever happens to be in the immediate vicinity and eats that. That is an instinctual output, an instinctual satisfaction of this instinctual input, this hunger. And the wonderful vision of Isaiah chapter 11 aside, lions do not eat straw like oxen, right? Lions eat lion food. So how human animals should behave in contrast to this. You know, here we have the body and this instinctual input, which is we have the same instinctual inputs as do the non-human animals. We get hungry, we get thirsty, we get sleepy, we get the desire to reproduce ourselves, these sort of things. But we do not satisfy this through mere instinct. We can. But it seems to be that one of the things that is called for in something like Leviticus 11 or Deuteronomy 14 is a ethical output or satisfaction of the need. So we do not just eat because we are hungry. We do not just drink something because we are thirsty. We do not just satisfy these needs in any way possible. But God calls us to think about what we were doing and to satisfy these instinctual inputs, these biological needs, as an act of worship. Doing the things, the small things that we need to do every day to survive. We are given a brain. We are given a heart to think about these things. And so far as we know, the non-human animals, this is the distinction between human animals and non-human animals, that is that they only satisfy these instinctual needs through instinctual satisfaction, whereas we are called and gifted by God to think about what we're doing. So the ethics of food, eating, is an ethical activity, or it is an activity that has ethical implications. What's the most common food item here in the Philippines? Rice. Statistics saw just the other day, 6.8 billion pesos worth of rice is wasted yearly here in the Philippines. Do any of us have 6.8 billion pesos? It's hard for me to even count that high. Wow. Imagine how this is in a richer country like the United States of America or China. Food waste in the United States
estimated at $544 per person per year. Multiply that by 314 million people, 170.8 trillion. That's 1708 and then 11 zeros. Dollars. Wow. And in China, 2012 statistics, that was the most recent I could find, the wasted food annually in China could feed 200 million people for 1 year. Which means that the amount of food wasted in China could feed one-fifth of the population of China for 1 year. The population of the world is expected to reach 9 billion people in just another 20 years or so. And the amount of food production that is necessary to feed that number of mouths is something like 70% higher than what is produced now. But then we throw away our food. Now this isn't what Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14 are directly talking about, for sure. Population of the world wasn't the size it was, and we don't have the technology that they did not have the technology that we do, and all of these sorts of things. But the idea is the same, that these little things that we do every day matter. They make a difference, even for eternity. Yeah, we talk about, especially among evangelical Protestants like we all are, we talk about decisions for Jesus, becoming a Christian, making an eternity of difference. And yes, that's true. But there's also all kinds, all manner of decisions and choices that we make every day and have eternal implications. So here's a short video that I'd like to share with you from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization.
Each year, one-third of all the food the world produces is lost or wasted. Not only does this mean an economic loss, it means that all of the natural resources used for growing, processing, packaging, transporting, and marketing that food were also wasted. Imagine! 28% of the world's agricultural land grows crops that are wasted. That equals the total land area of China, Mongolia, and Kazakhstan. Plus, the water wasted in growing those crops equals the annual flow rate of the Zambezi or the Volga rivers, an amount that could cover all the world's household water needs. And as agriculture and fisheries expand into wild areas, overexploit natural resources, forest and marine habitats are lost, along with their biodiversity. Above all, wasted food emits some 3.3 gigatons of greenhouse gases. If this were a country, it would represent the third largest emitting country in the world. This cannot continue. With a future of more people and fewer resources, we cannot afford to throw our natural resources out with the garbage. Let's do something about wastage. Food producers can invest in better harvest and storage technology to avoid food loss. Food retailers can reduce prices of that imperfectly shaped vegetable and donate unsellable yet edible surplus grocery food to those in need. Food not fit for human consumption should be reused to feed animals. Individual consumers can be more careful shoppers, use better methods to store and recycle leftovers, and request smaller portions in restaurants. Small efforts add up. The food wastage pyramid is based on garbage. Policymakers can enhance the ability of producers, retailers, and consumers to turn that pyramid around. For example, develop capacities of food producers to adopt post-harvest technologies. Revise those sell-by expiration dates so perfectly safe food is not discarded. Launch awareness-raising campaigns to inspire consumers to take whatever steps they can to stop food wastage. Reduce landfills through investments in transforming food waste into compost and biogas. The solution starts with you. Each producer, supermarket, household, restaurant, and nation has a part to play. It will take the commitment of all to reduce food loss and waste, so that all the natural resources used to produce food will end up as meals for the world's population, instead of as garbage in landfills.
We sang a song earlier that says, "With all I am, everything that I have been given, everything that I've gone through, everything that we've gone through, we lay it down before the Lord." We can make ethical, religious, God-glorifying decisions in the things that we do. And sometimes the areas in which those decisions are to be made are areas that we have never even thought of before. The food laws, in part, were meant to reduce the cruelty of non-human animals meeting their instinctual biological needs. But suffering continues when we do not think about what we are doing. When we only meet our instinctual input through instinctual output. And as seminarians, as future leaders, present leaders in many cases, we can take a leadership role. We talk about preparing leaders. We can take a leadership role in educating the people we come in contact with about these kinds of issues. Things that sometimes people might not even think about, but that have eternal significance. Let's pray.